The House Elections Committee will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We do not yet have a quorum. Assume we will soon. When we do, though, we only have some minor business to cover that requires a vote. Fortunately, this is a committee where we're going to do a lot of listening today and not a lot of talking, we hope, on our end. I do want to welcome someone who's not on the committee but a member who's with us, Representative Kathy Briner of the Mankato area, who's here in part because some of her constituents will be testifying today, and we thank Representative Briner for taking time out of her busy schedule to be here. She doesn't serve on the committee, but she shares a real interest for these issues. I want to thank everyone else who's in the audience for coming today. As you know, this is an overview hearing, our second hearing of the committee, dedicated, to my mind, to an important subject, and that is the subject overall of voting delays that occurred in the last election. I think it's an important topic because we in Minnesota and in the United States in general hold ourselves up to the highest of standards when it comes to the functioning of our elections. And when we look across the world at the price that many have paid for the right to vote, and we look at the price we paid in the United States and those who even died for our right to vote, I think it's important that we have as frictionless a system as possible. And in this day and age, in the United States of America, we ought to make sure that citizens who show up to vote, apart from the usual convenience that is born of the enthusiasm and high turnout that we've come to enjoy in Minnesota, apart from those things, I think it's important that we not have undue delays. And the jurisdiction of this committee is not, and I want to repeat this, and I will again, so that members who are not here yet will hear it again. The purview of this committee is not, nor is it our goal at this hearing today, to be accusatory. This is not that. This is not the venue for that. We're not here to call out individuals for any technical mistakes or other mistakes. I'm not interested in that, and that's not a real good use of our time. What I do want this hearing to be about is to hear the stories and viewpoints of folks who experienced voting delays or have some knowledge about the voting delays, and let's talk about the systemic changes, which is the purview of this committee, the systemic changes which we think can do some good for all of Minnesota. Interestingly, today we have an example, and there are many more that we did not highlight just because of time. We have examples from two communities that we'd like to take testimony on, Minneapolis, but also from greater Minnesota in the Mankato area where there were some voting delays. As I said, there were others in other parts of the state, but in the interest of time, we decided to focus on only a two, and those two, and you know that there was some press attention paid in those communities and elsewhere to the voting delays. But I want to emphasize again, this is not an accusatory committee hearing where we're looking to call out or embarrass individuals. We're just trying to get a whiff or a sense of systemic problems and issues. That's what this is about. So I hope members will keep that in mind. I mean, I'm going to repeat it as other members come in. And we also, I should say, in the latter part of this hearing, are going to be hearing from the Campaign Finance Board. So we're fitting a lot into this, and I want to make room for the testifiers who are here, at least one of whom has come on a lunch break and needs to get back to a job in another city on a lunch break, so I appreciate that. So I don't know if our first testifier is here. She's not here, and I think this was the person we're talking about. So I'll go to the second person on the list. I plan to go in order unless there's some reason someone isn't here. The next person on the list would be Karen. The three Mankato folks, I think, are going to come up at one time here. So let's have Karen Myers, the Deputy Director of Blue Earth County License Center, Miriam Brownhausen, Blue Earth County Election Judge, and Malda Farnham, Blue Earth County Election Judge, if they could come up and just share with us their observations, their stories, their thoughts. And I would ask the testifiers, too, and I know we have a lot to cover today, if you would talk a little bit, if you have any sort of systemic recommendation, even if it's just at a very high level and a broad level for us to consider, I think that would be helpful because that is the purview of this committee, not the sort of micro issues that you all have to contend with. That can be solved at the municipal or the county level. But what I'm concerned about and what we are is the sort of systemic things that we might do or might entertain to solve those problems. So I don't know which of you wishes to go first. I just would also ask, too, if we're getting some interference, obviously. I don't know where it's from, but if people could turn off their devices right now, that would be helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Karen Myers. I'm the Deputy Director of License Center Elections in Blue Earth County. I have with me today two head election judges. We also do the elections for the city of Mankato, and these are two head election judges from the city of Mankato. To my right is Miriam Brownhausen, and to my left is Malda Barnum.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Karen. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As Karen has stated, I serve as head election judge in Precinct 9 for the City of Mankato and Brewer County for the 2012 general election. This precinct had 1,542 registered voters at 7 a.m. Because many college students live in this precinct and new housing developments are coming up and the precinct lines were redrawn in 2012, this number did not accurately reflect who currently lived in the precinct. By the close of the polls that night, we had a total of 1,549 voters, but of that total, we registered 610 voters. That is close to 40% of the precinct voters being registered on the same day as elections. It is hard to state how long the voters stood in line, but were I to guess, I would say between 45 and 60 minutes. I am unable to state how many voters left without voting because they could not see the end of the line, which was outside of the building. It is my belief that the long line was mostly due to same-day voter registration. These are some of the delays I observed. We have many college students. The college student list for many students was not up to date. I found out in talking to the students that if they do not register their new addresses with the college, the lists are not updated. Also, many of the students prefer to have their names not on the list for privacy reasons. Number two, some of the documents that voters tried to present for proof of current residency were medical bills, credit card bills, bank statements, other first-class mailings, rental leases, rent statements without utilities, and of course some junk mail. I think the most imaginative thing I saw was a student bringing in a cardboard shipping box with his current address on it. Needless to say, none of these documents are acceptable, and the voter had to leave to retrieve proper documents. Third, most renters have utilities in one roommate's name. Therefore, in order for these voters to register, they had to come with that roommate, who had to be registered, and then he would vouch for his other roommates. Fourth, twice we had the precinct finder in the precinct that did not list a current address. Upon calling the election offices, it was discovered the addresses were listed online, but the precinct finder had to be printed before the addresses were updated. Fifth, the time that was needed for the registration judges to check the voter registration applications was lengthy. I strongly support same-day registration and do not want it ended. While registering in advance is ideal, isn't there a way of doing same-day registration electronically at the polling place? This would be much quicker and much more accurate. I asked a voter why he had not pre-registered. He stated that he had found the registration form online, but when he realized that he had to print it out, fill it out, and mail it, he realized he did not own an envelope nor a stamp because he does everything online. Therefore, he chose to register on election day. I would like to state that even though the 2012 general election lines were longer than usual, I saw the same lines in the 2008 elections at the same location. That year, we had a total of 1,063 voters, so 500 less, but we registered 536, which is a little greater than 50% of the voters for that day. The problem, 2008 problems were similar to 2012, but the wait time was probably less because we had less voters. I thank you, Chairman Simon, and House Elections Committee members for your time. I hope I have been helpful. I look forward to any reforms you are able to pass to alleviate long voter lines and to continue Minnesota's amazing voter turnout. I will gladly entertain any questions you would have, either now or after Malda speaks. Thank you.
Thank you. I recommend that we just maybe wait until the formal presentations are done, and we all might have some questions. Is there anything
Thank you.
You'd like to?
I'm Malda Farnham, and I'm also a head judge. I'm not on campus, but many students also vote in my precinct. In the military, there's a statement, prior planning prevents pretty poor performance. Maybe not using the pretty, but and so I attempt to deal with that. I check out the room. I plan in my head how everything is going to be placed. I contact the election judges ahead of time. I tell them what it is that I'd like them to do as a duty. This person will be a registration judge. This will be a ballot judge. Whatever it is. And then I ask them to read that three times for the last 3 days before the election, because they will not have time really to look up things in the book. They will have to spend a lot of time knowing what comes up. So last year in this particular precinct, and I was the first time that I was a head judge in this precinct. I had not been there before. Last year there were 1,342 people. That's 4 years ago. This year there was 1,807 people, 500 people increase. In new registrations, the last general election there were 461. This year there were 865. We were basically staffed for a much smaller number. Fortunately, I had a lovely, huge room. It was the size of a small gymnasium, a small high school gymnasium. By the time that we were towards the end, or by 5 o'clock, the place was full of people, because people would come in, and people did not have any problem at all if they came in and they went to the ballot, roster judges, and their name was already there, and everything was in order. They could go and they could vote. But those that registered had to come in, go get the form to be filled out for the registration. Then, and they had to stand in line to get to the registration desk. I had three people doing registration, and it was not enough. But we had no more people. Then we had, then they had to go stand in another line to get to the registration desk the second time. And this time, somebody looked at it to see that it was correct, looked at their identification, and so on. And then they had to go and stand in line. Yes, in order. Well, they didn't stand in line to get the ballot, but they had to stand in line to get to one of the privacy booths. We had 13 privacy booths, and they were full almost all the time. And why were they full? Because some people took as much as 45 minutes to cast their ballot. And why did they do that? They were reading the amendments. They either didn't know the amendment, or they just couldn't decide what the difficulty in that was. So we went on for quite a long time. But at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I wound up doing nothing but traffic management, because the people would come to put the ballot in the ballot box, to have it counted. They might have left something blank. Now, the person who would normally be working with that was preparing the new ballots to be cast from the books that had to be initialized and stuff. And everything needed to be done. We could not get ahead of ourselves. Everything that needed to be done got done. But so then somebody had left something blank. It came back. They didn't understand. So I would go and help them. Sometimes they still didn't understand after even reading what it said. So finally I would say, would you like me to look at your ballot and see what it is that you didn't do quite correctly? And sometimes I said, I think you'd better, we need a new ballot for you, and this will be a voided ballot. Other times I suggest that there's just one little thing to do. After you do it, come back, and then a machine will take that. Or you can send it in as is. But it took so much time. by mid-afternoon, I had not seen anybody from registration. I would be standing up, and they would be sitting down, and they had there was a mob of people, even though they tried to get them in lines. So I began to do lines there, too. I managed traffic for the rest of the day. At the end of the day, I thought, there is no way that any of our numbers will match, and Karen will tell me where to go. But she didn't. And as a matter of fact, the reason she didn't, because the numbers matched. The number of receipts was the number of people who had voted. Relax. At that point, I think I ate my lunch, because that's the way it was with most people. They hadn't eaten all day long. And somehow we got done with it. There's a couple things I would like to suggest. I think that the amendments were difficult to understand. I worked for a computer company once, and everything was simple. You know, it's either yes or no. If you do this, then this happens. If you do this, then this happens. It would be really nice if the amendments would clearly state what happens if you vote for something and what happens if you vote against something. The second thing I would like to bring up is the place was full and I had a big room, about three times bigger, I believe, than the other room that was described. What happens when you don't have that large space? And in Mankato, we're running out of large spaces. We now have had to go to churches, and they find it difficult to host us sometimes. So I wish that our ability to vote would start earlier than just on election day or absentee, because if we want to maintain the high number of voters that we have, we need to extend something. And I think we're at the top, as far as holding elections where we are.
Before we go on, Ms. Myers, are you wanting to add to that at this point?
If you would like to move on.
Well, I think that some members, including me, have some questions. Before we do that, a couple of housekeeping things. Representative Dowd has some folks here he wants to introduce. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Last fall, I took a tour of a youth residential facility in my district, and I promised them at that time, they did such a nice job showing me around, I promised them that I would invite them down to the Capitol and show them around, and they're here today. They are from the Bar None Youth Ranch, just south of St. Francis. So I think they're behind me here. So please welcome them to the committee.
Yes, welcome, and thanks, Representative Dowd. One other housekeeping item. I'm hoping that our vice chair will move the minutes of our last meeting.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of our last meeting.
Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Okay, minutes are adopted. In terms of questions, I'll start out. First, Ms. Brownhausen, you talked about the college lists not being up to date. Is that something you had seen before? Was that a glitch in this? And do you think the issue there is that students need to be doing more, or do you think it's that the colleges themselves maybe weren't quite as up to date, or is it none of the above?
First of all, it is not a new glitch. I had seen it before. I've served as election judge since the year 2000 and had election judge, therefore, for four general elections. Had the same problems at those times. That's how I know why the lists aren't up to date. Is it a college problem? Yes, but I have to respect, I'm dealing with students living off campus also, and I have to respect their right to privacy. I understand if those student lists are up to date, they get a lot of junk mail. Because my voters are living off campus, they usually do have rental agreements, a lease, utility bills. So the student list would be great if it were up to date, but not mandatory.
Okay. I guess I understand that. I wanted to ask Ms. Farnham a question. You talked about barely being able to eat your lunch, and about the time pressures. I mean, it's a 13-hour day. Well, it's more than 13 hours. The polls open at 7, close at 8. That's just the formal period, but there's the before and after. It's a very long day. And my observation has been that, you know, recruiting and retaining election judges is an important thing, but it's a hard thing. I guess the first question I have is maybe ultra obvious, but would more election judges help? And second is, do you have any ideas about how we get there?
I think Karen could, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I believe that Karen could speak us through the retention and recruiting. She does all of that. And probably it would help somewhat, but you know, sometimes you get more people and there's more confusion. And so I wish that the precincts could be somewhat smaller or fewer number. 1,000 people would, you know, would be something that one could handle. But then those are just my thoughts that I have not thought through completely.
Okay. I don't know if you care to comment on that, Ms. Myers.
Mr. Chair, we staff our precincts one judge for every 150 votes. So in some of those precincts, we had over 20 election judges. And it was just the high voter turnout where we were having problems, even with highly staffed.
Okay.
And it is hard to get judges.
Okay. I have another question, but I want to turn to some member questions. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for all the testifiers. The delays that you experienced this time, was this an abnormality? I mean, was it brought on because of the redistricting, or pens that didn't work, or whatever? I mean, maybe some of you, I don't know how long you have been serving, but you know, through past redistrictings, I mean, is this something that comes up every 10 years, or was this an abnormality?
Mr. Chairman, members, in my, I have actually, I don't know, been an election judge maybe for 15, 16 years, something to that effect. This was more extreme than I had noticed before. And it has, because the number of people have in fact increased, and the more new register someone on election day and have them go through, I would estimate that it takes maybe 3 to 4 times the time that it takes for just or more than that. That it takes a long time because you have to read the whole sheet, make sure that the person entered every box and that they've done that in such a way that it would be appropriate. So there's a lot to the process, and that's what takes so long a time. And secondly, in our particular area, when the people voting want, taking the time to stand in long lines to get into the privacy booths, and this was about, I would say, 5 o'clock in the evening, I said to basically students at that time, I said, if any of you don't care if somebody happens to see who you voted for, what you voted for, then just go to a wall, go to a floor, write out everything you need to write out or check everything you want to check. I don't care where you do it, just bring the ballot and to the ballot box. So you see, it gets, you sort of just do what you can.
Thank you. Representative Mariani, I want to say, you know, we've got a lot of testifiers here, and some of them could answer the same question. Is this specific to the folks from Mankato? Go ahead, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Matt. Mr. Chair, just, and I forget your name, I'm sorry, but.
Malda Farnham.
Ms. Farnham, I'm sorry. So you had shared that one of the things that happened in this year was the two amendments that were on the ballot, and your observation is that people were reading the amendments and thinking about them, which I think is appropriate, right? People want to do, really understand what it is. Those tend to be unusual in terms of occurrences. It's not, every year that we have certainly two, you know, constitutional amendments. That's not a usual thing. So my question is, how do you know that? The people just came up and just told you, say, Ms. Farnham, you know, I'm sorry it took so long, but, you know, I was really, really reading carefully through, you know, the whole issue. Did you just sort of do an assessment by interacting with folks in that way? Or?
If I might answer that.
Ms. Farnham.
Yes, I would watch. It was basically the older people who used to kind of zip through, and they had wanted to really take their time. It wasn't the students, and I was trying to pay attention to that. The people who were really conscientious, wanting to do the right thing. And the last time that we had something on the ballot like that, I believe, was when we voted in to have the extra tax, is it 3% or 7% tax taken out, and sales tax for the good works, I call it.
The good works.
Yeah, and very...
Ms. Farnham, you happen to be talking to the chair of the committee until recently who doled out all that money, so he likes it a lot.
But right, yeah.
Well, thank you. Members, you know, we're going to hear from some other testifiers, and we can always call folks back. And there's one person who I hope is here who is coming on, I believe, her lunch hour. Is Ms. Ahmed here? No, maybe she's not here yet. Well, then I'd like to call up a couple of other just voters, everyday voters. We have with us Dean Olson, and maybe to save time, if Mr. Eric Reichwald could also come up, if he's here. Mr. Olson, if you could go first and just share your thoughts with us. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
All right. Well, my name is Dean Olson. I live in the Seward neighborhood in Minneapolis. I live in an apartment building that's primarily elderly and disabled people. And for years, we had a polling place that was only about a block away, which was pretty convenient for the residents. But when we had the primary election, the last one, we were moved, and I noticed that where we used to vote, the polls were still in that building, but even the residents in that building weren't allowed to vote in their own building, which I thought was very strange. But they were all, including people in my building, we were shunted about half a mile away to another apartment building, which did not have adequate space, which I wish we had like Mankato did, because when I went to vote around 2 o'clock on election day, people had said they were waiting up to 3 hours, and I waited outside in the cold, and then it started freezing rain for about an hour. Some of the residents in my building were stuck out there too. The next day they had some severe chest problems and coughing problems. But we did our duty, and I feel glad that the sacrifice is worth it. I'm just glad we didn't die from it, though. But one of the other problems I noted was that When we finally got in to vote, when I got in to vote, which is about 2.5 hour wait, half of the voting booths were empty. And I thought, well, what's the matter here? And it may be because of the new registrations and the fact that the people at that precinct hadn't adjusted to the high-rise buildings, including my own, that were coming into that. And they just didn't have enough staff to handle it. And so it caused a huge line. In my own anger at the situation and seeing my neighbors forced to stand out there and suffer under such circumstances, I called Representative Phyllis Kahn, and I'm glad that she answered the call and came over to see if she could help speed the process up a bit before the polls closed. So I would hope in the future that in our precinct that at least when they have polls, in an apartment building, the people in the building itself can vote, and that in, also in the future that they do have enough staff when they know that a large incoming new population will be flooding the registration areas. So I think a little better planning would have helped a lot.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reichwald.
My name is Eric Reichwald. I live in North Minneapolis, District 59B. I think before I say anything else, I want to say I've worked as an observer for 2008, 2010, and this year's 59B recount. I've also been a poll watcher on several occasions. I'm not questioning the integrity of the process. I think our process is excellent. I think the city of Minneapolis does an excellent job with its elections. That being said, on election day, I was, last two elections I voted absentee because I knew I'd be out of the district on election day. This year I was working in the district on a campaign and knew I'd be in the district, so I thought I'd just go to the polls. I first went at 10. The wait was over an hour and a half long. I had to return to work. Came back at 2. The wait was an hour and a half long. The line was going up and out the door at North Point Community North Health Center. Finally came back at 7:45, just knowing if I stayed in line, at least I'd get to vote. But several people I watched walk away each time I was there. I mean, dozens of people each time. And I can't tell you how many of them came back. I happened to live 6 blocks from my polling station and was working out of the home that day. It, you know, I was able to come back. And plus, I've never missed a vote. But as the folks Mankato was speaking about, a gymnasium-sized room. Our room was less than a third of the size of this, with at any given time 200 to 300 people lined up to get into it. Judges did a phenomenal job. Registration did their phenomenal job. But there was just they were understaffed for their needs. I mean, our turnout has gone up and up since 2008 in my district, and I think we can foresee it continuing to go up as we continue to voter registration. If I could offer any suggestions, you know, it would be that be it early voting or absentee voting without cause to open that up and make that more possible. For me that day, I would have voted. You know, I would have been voting ahead of time. I would have been back there 3 times in one day. And I can only imagine how many people come back over and over, and you know they don't come back for the third time, and that's what I'm worried about. You know, that was my big concern. And again, the process itself, the integrity of which, having watched the recounts and having been a poll watcher, I've never seen cheating, and I feel very confident in the process. But we need to expand that so the base itself, voters, isn't discouraged. You know, election day can't be the end all and be all, and you know, absentee voting being not that restrictive in this state, let's be honest. If you want to vote absentee, you just say you want to need to vote absentee, you can vote absentee. But there's no reason we want people lying. We don't want people dodging the law. And, you know, so I'd just like to say that for every person that me that goes back 3 times, I'm sure there are many who won't go back, and they've lost their chance to vote, and their voice isn't heard. And that is my major concern. That's why I'm here today.
Well, let me ask you the question, Mr. Reichwald, that I asked to the folks from Mankato, too. You've mentioned a couple of things that you might help. This issue of precinct size. It sounds like all over Minnesota, if these two communities are to be are considered representative, that might be an issue. So I'll ask you first, do you think that the precinct size is too large, where you apparently have voted for a while? And second, do you think that more election judges would help, or is that
in our
not
case,
really
the physical space? The physical space the physical space itself was packed. So they had as many judges in there as much space we could take up. Are the precincts too large? No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm very active in precinct politics. You know, there's only so many spaces with so many precincts in the state that we can. I mean, if we were to have more precincts, that would mean more polling stations, and that would make it, you know, we know how hard it is to find space. I've worked in other things. I worked for the Census Bureau, where I had to find dozens of spaces every week to use for recruiting and testing. That was hard enough. You know, if we were to decrease our precinct size and increase the voting locations, I'm not sure that's as much of a solution as increasing the opportunity to vote by allowing either early voting or absentee voting without cause. Because, you know, we do have limited public resources. We can't be everywhere at once as much as we'd like to be. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I live in a corner of Penn and Plymouth where we have voting stations on 3 out of the 4 corners for 4 different precincts. Urban League's there, University has a place there, North Point's there. None of them have a singular place that could take on the 3 precincts. Thus, if we were to reduce it, to try to find 6 locations, you would spread people out more, cause more confusion. I don't know your name. But when you had people who had to leave their own buildings in the polling stations at their buildings to go over somewhere else, you know, that does not solve the problem. That discourages people, particularly if it's people that have mobility issues or transportation issues of any kind. So, you know, I don't know if the precincts are too big as much as we need more opportunity for voting.
Let me just put out a call here. Is Ms. Ahmed here yet? I don't know if she's arrived or will. Hopefully she will. Okay, I want to remember, is there any pressing question for these two individuals as opposed to just kind of general comments or questions? Because if not, I'd like to move on, if I could, briefly to Casey Carl, the Minneapolis City Clerk, to share some perspective. And then I might want to talk to some of the Mankato folks again, some questions I have just about administration. But go ahead.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. As they're getting situated, I'll remind folks that there's a letter in your packets from a Minneapolis voter, Priscilla Russell, from Northeast Minneapolis, who couldn't make it today but wanted to share with you her impressions and observations. Okay. Mr. Carl, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Casey Carl. I have the privilege of serving as city clerk for the city of Minneapolis. With me are my colleagues, Grace Bachlerowitz, who is to my right. She is the assistant city clerk and director of elections and voter services. To my left is election specialist Judy Schwartau. We also have in the audience a policy analyst with my office, Peter Ebnett, and we're joined by Jean Ranieri, the director of the city's intergovernmental relations department. We appreciate the concern and discussion about concerns and experiences that were had in 2012. We believe reforms to election processes are needed, and we welcome the opportunity to be here today to discuss those potential reforms, especially one of those that we think would be helpful, early voting. Before I get to that, though, Mr. Chair, I think a few brief comments about 2012 may be important. For context, every 20 years, the requirement to redistrict all of our political boundaries collides with the planned presidential election. In 2012, that collision created some challenges which, at least in part, resulted in long lines and wait times at our polling places. But to be clear, what we experienced in 2012 is not the norm for elections. It's the exception that occurs every 20 years. We don't believe that the occasional experience should dictate or distract from positive reform efforts that can enhance and improve the administration of elections and service to voters across all years. What we do know is that ballot content primarily derives voter turnout. 2012 was a presidential election, and historically we expect, and we usually get, the highest turnout in presidential elections. On top of that, however, we had two constitutional amendments that were submitted to voters, which evoked strong interest on all sides. That combination of presidential election and two provocative ballot questions, along with a number of other high-profile races occurring in a year immediately after redistricting all of our political boundaries, resulted in the highest turnout experienced in Minneapolis since voting rights were extended to those aged 18 and up in 1971. On Election Day, Minneapolis served 200,661 voters, which included in that number 50,668 voters who registered on Election Day in order to cast the ballot. Translated, that means one in every four voters were same-day registrants, 25% of our total turnout in Minneapolis, roughly equivalent to the population of the city of Minnetonka. Processing a voter, as has already been said, who needs to register on election day takes significantly more time and attention from election judges than those voters who are pre-registered. That extra time and attention delays service to other voters. And as the largest municipality, Minneapolis has a number of other challenges in serving a very diverse population. Noticeably, language barriers. In our community, we must accommodate three major and four minor languages, which requires special attention to the recruitment of qualified interpreters, as well as contingency plans that we have to put in place to address a minimal level of support to serve our voters in the event we are unable to get a qualified interpreter. These and a number of other issues were identified in a report presented to our Minneapolis City Council on December 3rd. A copy of that report is available from the city's website, and that report included a number of recommendations that we intend to improve the administration of election processes, one of which is early voting. We've provided the committee with a series of handouts. The first is a demographic profile of Minneapolis as an election jurisdiction. The second is a policy brief we prepared on early voting and its use throughout the United States. And finally, a glossary of election terms from the perspective of an elections administrator. As indicated in our glossary, early voting can be thought of as an umbrella term. That's because it is used to connote entirely different procedures in different jurisdictions. And for example, it can include no excuse, absentee voting, vote by mail, and in-person advance voting. The common denominator amongst all of these procedures is that they are generally completed prior to election day during a statutorily prescribed period of time. So at root, early voting extends the voting period, and as a result, it maximizes voter convenience and voter choice. And because voters can participate at earlier times, this reform may ease congestion at polling places on election day, which could relieve long lines and wait times. The United States has extensive experience with early voting, beginning in Texas in 1988. And nonpartisan research shows a growing percentage of voters enjoy early voting. Looking only at presidential elections since 1992, approximately 7% of the electorate at that time used early voting in those states authorizing it. By 2008, that percentage had increased to more than 30% of the electorate that took advantage of early voting in those states across the nation where the laws allow its use. Currently, 32 states and the District of Columbia offer some form of early voting, as reflected in the map that's included in our materials. That map was created by the National Conference of State Legislatures. In our materials, we've also attempted to provide you with a snapshot of the experiences of these other states and how those experiences may or may not be relevant in Minnesota. I mentioned that early voting is a voter convenience. This is one of the reasons the City of Minneapolis seeks authorization to use this tool, because it would allow us to better serve our voters. The city's elections unit and our 311 call center handle a significant volume of calls in the weeks and days that lead up to an election. And very frequently we get the question of whether or not Minnesota allows early voting. And of course, the natural follow-up question that we get after answering is, why not? Minnesota enjoys an enviable national reputation for being a leader in elections. But new residents are puzzled why Minnesota doesn't allow early voting, especially savvy voters who are aware of or who may have experienced early voting in other states. The face of our nation is changing. The 2010 census demonstrated significant changes in racial and ethnic demographics. But at the same time, our society has become increasingly mobile, with global economies that impact local businesses and a 24-hour news media cycle and technology that impacts our lives at work, at home, and at play. Americans increasingly rely on the internet and personal mobile devices to access news, information, and commerce. And these realities affect how our voters approach elections and the influence they expect to have on their expectations and demand in how they conduct their voting rights. As election administrators, we're challenged to keep pace. With that background, early voting gives busy voters and voters with special needs an opportunity to cast their ballot at times which may be more convenient, less burdensome, and certainly less constrained by the limited window of an election day. For example, voters who have weekday time limitations, child care or parent care obligations, or who may be impacted as an hourly wage earner, these voters could potentially benefit by having expanded opportunities to cast a ballot outside of a single 13-hour election day. For those voters, avoiding the rush on election day can be a potential incentive to use early voting periods so that they can still participate in an election but get on with the business of their daily lives. Early voting also helps alleviate barriers for voters who may experience challenges because of access or mobility issues, and those who have language support requirements, or even students who are new to the community and who have additional burdens to prove residency, among other categories of voters who could use a little extra help. For these voters, casting a ballot outside of a crowded polling place when election judges can give extra time and attention is a benefit that early voting provides. More importantly, early voting increases the procedural integrity of casting a ballot, which results in a more accurate ballot count than does in-person absentee balloting. And that leads to my second point. Early voting is better than in-person absentee balloting or absentee voting, because it provides greater security and accuracy of the ballot and does not require a voter to claim one of a handful of narrowly prescribed excuses in order to exercise their constitutional right to vote. In early voting, a voter is able to cast his or her ballot and have it immediately processed by a tabulator. There is no delay, and there is no difference from the experience that they have on election day. That gives additional security to the voter because the tabulator will notify the voter of any potential errors with their ballot, such as an undervote or an overvote. In this way, a voter would be able to correct his or her ballot and still have it processed by the tabulator in their presence. Because of this, early voting also helps ensure the accuracy of the ballot, which is good for that voter and good for the election process. The plain truth is that this extra level of security, instant feedback, and overall accuracy simply is not provided in the absentee ballot process. When absentee balloting does provide is extra documentation, increased administrative costs, and procedural requirements that can be confusing and cumbersome to voters. And as an unfortunate consequence, it can lead to a high rate of errors that cause ballots to be rejected. In 2012, for example, more than 15,021 Minneapolis voters applied for an absentee ballot. That number is greater than about 100 cities and townships across the state. Of that total, 14,157 absentee ballots were completed and submitted. And as an aside, 1,631 of those total absentee ballots were received by my office on the day before Election Day and up until 3 p.m. on Election Day. That late submission creates enormous staffing challenges, separate and apart from the task of staffing 117 different precincts and serving more than 200,000 voters at polling places. Of the total number of absentee ballots that were received, 440 were initially rejected due to errors by the voter. Staff took extraordinary means to reach out to all of these voters whose absentee ballots were rejected in order to give them an opportunity to correct and resubmit an absentee ballot. Of that total number of initial rejections, about half, 220, were corrected, resubmitted, accepted, and counted. That's the good news. Unfortunately, despite our best efforts to the contrary, 220 absentee ballots were never counted in time and were ultimately rejected and not counted. And in those instances, it's possible the voter may never know that his or her ballot was not counted until well after the election is over. Early voting minimizes the impact of absentee voting for those who can cast their ballots in person prior to Election Day and who may do so if given the option. Additionally, early voting opens the process to all qualified voters because it doesn't require a voter to provide a valid excuse like is currently required under the absentee process in Minnesota. Early voting eases the burden on election administrators, too, and reduces the laborious and time-intensive process associated with the handling of absentee ballots. Early voting would reduce the high cost associated with postage, documentation, envelopes required for absentee voting, secure storage, and the significant staff time that's required to receive, verify, accept or reject, and ultimately tabulate absentee ballots. Absentee balloting creates a separate duplicate track for voting. Again, early voting provides the exact same experience for voters that they receive on Election Day. And as reflected in the handouts that we provided, states have defined early voting periods differently, and Minnesota would need to consider the appropriate time frame for early voting that serves its voters. Certainly, we understand that one size does not, cannot, fit all needs or circumstances. Mr. Chair, perhaps the most important thing I can say today is this. The City of Minneapolis supports election reform that increases voter engagement, that supports all voters who choose to participate in an election, and that simplifies the process and offers all voters convenience and choice in how they exercise their constitutionally protected right to vote. Early voting can help us achieve these objectives. It is not, however, a cure-all for the myriad issues and challenges that confront us. Nor does our advocacy for early voting diminish the importance of Election Day and preparations for Election Day. Again, early voting is a tool. It's another way for us to serve our voters, to give voters the maximum benefit of casting a ballot that can be checked for accuracy before being counted in their presence, to relieve pressures on the polling place for those decided voters who have already made up their mind about how they want to vote in advance of Election Day and want the opportunity to do so. We believe it's a good tool, one that has proven effective in other states and it has promise for Minnesota, which is why we've advocated for early voting for several years now. We know that any legislative proposal needs to account for the unique conditions and circumstances of communities across the state, from townships and small communities to the metropolitan communities that make up the Twin Cities region. Across the spectrum of all of these communities, the needs of voters must be considered within broad policy parameters that preserve and protect the integrity, transparency, accountability, and fairness of the election process. Those fundamental principles on which our election system is based, we think, should be the guide. By focusing on those principles, I believe this committee can engage stakeholders in a process to determine how early voting could be implemented in Minnesota. Certainly, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and especially the Secretary of State are key contributors to those discussions, and we join with them in supporting your work. With that, Mr. Chair, I've concluded my prepared comments.
Thank you. I don't know if the other folks you brought care to testify. I just have a quick question. As you probably know, we've talked in this committee, and the governor has talked about the need for bipartisanship in this area. So one area I wanted to ask you about and also get the view of some of the Mankato folks is this. I think there is some common ground to be had on the issue of electronic poll books. And I've talked with some of the advocates from other groups on a wide ideological spectrum about that. And I know that poll books can be used for various purposes. You can use them for election to make the election day registration process run more smoothly. You can use them for pre-election day registrants, and you can use them, of course, as a verification tool if you include photos. I guess my question to you is, do you think that idea can bear fruit? Do you think that would have helped if something like that would have been in place, say, for same-day registrations? Do you not have an opinion? What do you think about the idea of electronic poll books? Good idea, bad idea, something else?
Mr. Chair, I think the use of technology to streamline our processes is important. We would support that. And I think the use of technology, which might include electronic poll books, could help us streamline the most difficult piece for us, which is registration, particularly on election day. Same-day registration is a very burdensome process. And if we had the technology that could streamline that, automate it, and make it quicker, it would help us to push through those voters who need or want to use same-day registration in order to cast their ballot. So we would be supportive of that.
Okay. I mean, and members should know, I mean, this is an idea. I've talked with Representative Sanders about it, and I sense that there's a bipartisan appetite to at least explore this idea, at least on a pilot project basis. But the more that I learn about it and speak with election professionals about it, the more I realize there are a lot of moving parts and a lot of technical dimensions to it that I don't pretend to understand in terms of at the software level and other things like that. I'm certainly intrigued by it, and I think we can get some bipartisan buy-in on that issue. The question becomes then, for what purpose do you use it? How wide a net should we cast in terms of a pilot project? What, of course, are the costs? Those are things that we as a committee, I think, over the next year or so, will have to flesh out if we want to move forward with this. But it seems to me, since we want this to be as bipartisan a committee as possible, that's one area where we can find some common ground, one area I hope among many. I'm interested in getting the view of the Mankato folks on that issue, but two other things. First is our initial testifier here, is Ms. Ahmed here. I just want to make sure. She's the one who I'm told would have to come during her lunch hour. Okay. I want to make sure we get her in if she ends up coming and has to come. Unless members have very Minneapolis-specific questions, I'd like to call up again the Mankato folks, if I could. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sorry, Representative Erdahl. Go ahead.
Question. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering, what percent of absentee ballots are rejected or checked because of their excuses?
Because of an excuse of...
Are excuses ever rejected?
Mr. Chair, I would say to that question, we don't police the excuses that people may choose to use for absentee voting. The options are there for the voter to make at their discretion, and we process those as they're received.
Okay. That's actually a good question. There is no excuse police out there. I guess we basically take it on the voters' say-so that they're going to be gone from the precinct or gone from the district that day. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for your testimony and your time. I'd like to briefly call up the Mankato folks again, and the reason for doing this, again, is I wanted to fit in as many people as I could who had tight schedules, but since we have a little bit of extra time and not much, and as you're walking up, I'll ask you the same question on this issue of poll books, electronic poll books, as a possible way where we can find some bipartisan ground, at least on a pilot project basis. Do you think that idea would bear fruit? Do you think it's a bunch of hype? Does it depend on what purpose it's used for? Do you have any opinion on the idea of electronic poll books?
Mr. Chairman, if I could go first.
Please.
Electronic poll books at my precinct that day would have been a blessing. First of all, the three judges I had doing registration would not have to worry about if the registration's copy was readable. Inputting into an electronic book, make sure they're in the right precinct based on address. The human error would be cut out a lot at that point. Using it for same-day registration as well as a roster makes that program workable across the board. It would take six judges and put them on electronics, which would, as I feel, takes out a lot of human error.
Okay. And for the oral record, I failed to identify you, Ms. Brownhausen.
I'm Miriam Brownhausen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Ms. Farnham, any?
I agree with everything she said.
Okay. Ms. Myers, you're the administrator. Any thoughts about that?
Absolutely, and Lewis County would volunteer to be a pilot.
Well, we might hold you to that.
Precinct 9, especially.
Okay. Thank you. Any other member questions for the testifiers? Okay, well, we thank you for coming all this way and taking time of your lives to share with us some of your experiences. As I said before, members, these are but two examples of several around the state of some voting delays, and the purview of our committee is not to point fingers or be accusatory of this or that city or administrator. It's just to talk about the more systemic issues, and reasonable people can have different views on the outcomes there. So, oh, I'm sorry. Representative Dowd.
I just had a comment, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman. I just wanted to thank the ladies for serving as election judges. I've done that a couple of times myself, and it is a very thankless job, and so I appreciate you doing that.
That's very important to say. It is a thankless job, and it's a very long day. It really is a marathon day. I mean, 13 hours of voting alone, but you don't just come in there at 6:59 for 7 a.m. I mean, people are there. The ones who do stay the whole day are there a very long time. It's very taxing. And so thank you for doing what you do for Minnesota and for your communities. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Members, I think we're ready to go on to the second portion of today's hearing, which is an overview from the State Campaign Finance Board. As you know, the purview of this committee includes not only election processes and procedures, but campaign finance as well. And we're going to hear from the Campaign Finance Board and have them come up, and they have some materials for us as well. They're being handed out right now. Mr. Goldsmith, I'll turn it over to you to introduce yourself and your office and tell us what we need to know.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I'm here with the Assistant Director, Jeff Sigurdsson, and on behalf of the board, we want to express our appreciation to the committee for this opportunity to talk a little bit about the board itself and what we do, and we look forward to meetings in the future with this committee as we actually talk about the bills that we hope to have introduced. Today, we want to give an overview of the board, and then I want to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the principles of campaign finance regulation and familiarize yourself with the context of the law in which we work, because as you discuss the bills that we'll be bringing forward, these basic principles of law are going to be your guide throughout the whole process. So I'll talk a little bit about what we regulate and why, and what our authority for doing that is, and also about what we don't regulate and why we can't do that. Before I do that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Sigurdsson to do an introduction to the board.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. The two documents that I will be referring to, there's a one-page document that just is titled at the top, Overview of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The purpose of that is simply basically to condense the numbers. I do have a few hard numbers, which I'm going to provide you so you don't have to write those down if there's any number there that catches your ear. And then the second document, I do want to spend just a minute or so talking about our board members. And so I printed off a listing of our board members, which again I'll make a quick reference to as I go through this. The Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board has existed basically since 1974. Our task is to administer Chapter 10A, also known as the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Act. The board has a mission, which I'd like to read to you. It's to promote public confidence in state government decision-making through development, administration, and enforcement of disclosure and public finance programs, which will ensure public access to understanding of information filed with the board. That public confidence is a key issue. And as we go through the three programs, or as I go over quickly the three programs the board administers, I'll come back to that. to show how that fits into that schedule. But first, I'd like to give you a little bit of an introduction to the board. The board has six members. They're all appointed by the governor. They serve four-year terms. Very unique in Minnesota government. All the board members are confirmed by both the House and the Senate and require a three-fifths vote majority by both the House and the Senate to be confirmed. One position, in fact, will be before the committee this year as that term has expired. The committee is bipartisan. The effort is not to be nonpartisan, but rather bipartisan, with no more than one half the members affiliated with any one party. We have to have one former DFL legislator, one former Republican legislator. We have to have two members who have not been politically active in any way for at least 3 years. And we have to have two members who basically support different parties and who are sometimes referred to as the open seats. To support the efforts of the board, we have a staff currently of 7.6 staff, full-time equivalents. The board serves only for a $55 per diem board meeting payment. I would like to say that the board members put in a remarkable amount of work given that that level of compensation. Clearly, they are dedicated members of the public who wish to serve. It's not unusual for the packets of information that the staff provides the board members before a meeting to reach 300 pages in length. And yet they fight through that and are able to bring in marked up documents where they have questions and have issues they want to have addressed. So again, as you have a moment, if you want to look at this, you can see the background, some of the educational background. We have three attorneys serving on the board, two former business members, a retired member of the Office of Administrative Hearings, a retired judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. So we have a wide spectrum of individuals who provide their perspective to the board. The first and probably the best-known program that the board administers is the campaign finance program. Disclosure in campaign finance is, of course, to provide the public with, again, that confidence on the individuals and associations which are trying to affect the outcome of the election and how much resources those individuals and associations are putting into that effort. We have only state-level candidates, political parties and candidates, or excuse me, political committees and funds register with us. We have currently 755 state-level candidates. That was actually almost 1,000 before the primary endorsement process was done at the beginning of the year. We currently have 329 political party units registered with us. We have 355 political committees and funds. And then more recently, we've seen the development of more limited-use political committees and funds. That's the ballot question committees and funds, of which there are 26, and the independent expenditure-only political committees and funds, of which there are 31. Those two types are unique in that they can accept corporate funds, while the other types of entities, committees registered with us, may not. The board also administers the public subsidy program. In 2012, we paid $1 million, We facilitated the payment of $1,950,000 to state House and state Senator candidates. That's somewhat lower than you see in a year in which the constitutional officers are in the ballot, actually quite a bit lower. That number can almost be $4 million when the constitutional officers are on the ballot as well. Through the regulation of the campaign finance program, we basically, again, focus on disclosure. For 2012, we'll have over 5,800 reports filed with us. Those are immediately put out onto the web as a PDF format the day after the filing period. And so we do provide that raw access to the data. We have tried to, when I say we, the staff has internally tried to develop searchable databases, which are, again, web-based, with sort of a combination of success. It was initially, I think, viewed as a success, but as we look at what other states are able to provide, we realize that really we're only providing very raw data that's coming into us from the various committees and funds registered with us. We also then have a service strategy. We recognize that for the great majority of committees and party units, the treasurer is a volunteer. It's not what they do for a living. It's not even what they do for the majority of their time. So to try to support them, we provide a number of training sessions for the 2012 election cycle. We provided 51 training sessions on compliance and the use of campaign finance reporter. Very few of those anymore can be held out state. For the most part, we have to hold those right here in St. Paul, in the Centennial Office Building. We have access to a computer lab and to other facilities. We have very little ability to hold those sessions outstate anymore. We're trying to develop web-based applications and web-based training because, again, we recognize the treasurers are the ones who are sort of caught in this and that very few of them are, in fact, professional at that role. Campaign Finance reported the software, which I mentioned very briefly. Electronic filing is now required. There is a waiver process for that can be applied for, but the great majority of committees are now filing electronically. To support that, the board developed as a free application available to all registered committees, Campaign Finance Reporter, that provides not only a reporting device for treasurer, but it also has built-in compliance checking where it looks at all contributions, all expenditures, and tries to evaluate and give compliance warnings if there's a possible violation. Again, we find that just invaluable in terms of trying to help the volunteer treasurers try to avoid problems before they happen. And then lastly, in terms of providing strategies of support for those individuals, the board does have an advisory opinion process. There's over 400 advisory opinions now searchable online. And certainly if there are situations which are not clear in statute, the board will certainly take an advisory opinion request. There is a compliance angle to campaign finance. In 2012, the board entered into 26 conciliation agreements. Conciliation agreements are resolutions of relatively minor violations of statute. This is when somebody accepts a contribution that may be over the contribution limit or some other sort of more or less mundane almost. I shouldn't say mundane, but very much self-identified violations. We find these on the reports. Somebody will say that, well, I accepted $600, contribution limit is $500. Conciliation agreement will deal with that very quickly. On top of the conciliation agreements, though, there is the issue of findings. Findings are based on investigations. Those are typically more serious violations of Chapter 10A. There are 32 findings issued by the board. Mr. Goldsmith, I believe, will be talking about this later, but the number of investigations has been going up for the staff, and that they've been, in general, becoming much more complex as the issues have gone on. The second major program that the board administers is the lobbying program. Again, the lobbying program now is trying to provide information to the public on the individuals and associations that are attempting to influence official actions and provide confidence on the nature of that influence that they are trying to provide. Lobbying, of course, is attempting to influence the official actions by direct communications or by urging others to communicate with officials. So in Minnesota, we do have grassroots lobbying. If somebody is being paid to try to appeal to individuals to contact their legislator and they're being compensated at a certain level, that would in fact be lobbying. There are three types of lobbying in Minnesota: legislative, which I'm sure you're well aware of; administrative, which is when you're trying to influence administrative rules that are being promulgated by one of the state agencies; and then we do have a limited lobbying extension to the metropolitan governmental units. That's all of the counties in the seven county metro area and first class cities. Cities that are not of the first class are not covered by the lobbying statute, and any of the counties or cities outside the metropolitan area are not covered by the lobbying statute. Currently there's approximately 1,250 registered lobbyists, although I was told by our registrar that she received 90 registrations today, so that number is going up as the session begins. There are approximately 1,400 principals, which are associations which hire lobbyists. The lobbyists report to the board twice a year. The principals report once a year. That's all online, or at least the great majority of it is online through applications developed by the board. Just as a reference point, again, looking at in 2011, during that process of reporting, there was a total of $65 million in lobbying expenditures in Minnesota. The compliance effort here is typically securing reports, responding to complaints on failure to register, and providing guidance on the gift prohibition. The economic interest program, the third program, the one perhaps which you've been reading about in the newspapers lately, is to provide disclosure to that so that the public may be confident that official decisions are not being made in order to personally benefit public officials, but rather to identify possible conflicts of interest so that the public understands the motivations of why official actions occurred. The statement of economic interest are filed by candidates and, of course, by elected state office holders, but also by commissioners, deputy and assistant commissioners, executive officers of any agency that has the authority to adopt administrative rules, local officials, metropolitan governmental units, and other agencies and commissions that are listed in statute. We have in Minnesota currently 2,397 public officials who file those statements, and they represent or are employed by over 270 different agencies. So it's beyond just the state legislature in terms of public officials. And then lastly, on the economic interest, those statements are all placed on the website. They are available for public inspection. They disclose things like occupation, associated businesses that provide compensation of over $50 a month, securities that may be held that are worth more than $2,500, non-homesteaded property, interest in parimutuel horse racing. Those are all issues that the board may be addressing or is considering, at least, going forward with possible legislative recommendations. Our enforcement actions here are usually trying to track down the reports, especially with some of the water soil districts, so in water conservation districts, that it isn't always easy to get those reports. And of course, to make sure that we're able to provide the opportunity to update those statements in April, which is an obligation of all public officials. And that's just, a brief overview of the functions, the three major programs. If there aren't any questions, then Mr. Goldsmith has some additional information.
Before we transition from you to Mr. Goldsmith, Mr. Sigurdsson, I just want to say, and I think all members understand this, I mean, we're going to be touching on this session and into next year many of these areas, and I know there are members working on bills. I've been discussing with Representative Sanders on an ongoing basis what kind of bipartisan cooperation we can have on this. And I understand, Mr. Goldsmith, I assume you'll mention this in a minute, that the board already has had and will likely have into early February some particular recommendations, both on the campaign finance front and then also on the economic interest disclosure front. I assume you'll at least mention or touch on or hint at those right now, but I just wanted to get that clear for the record that we'll be considering, acting upon, and perhaps implementing some, most, probably not all, you never know, of these recommendations. But Mr. Goldsmith.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will, tomorrow, through interoffice mail, get to each of you the official version of the board's recommendations. Now, these are not in bill form. These are just generic recommendations. And I can tell you that they will focus largely on campaign finance, and that's going to be the topic I'll mostly talk about today in the next 10 minutes or so. There is also a recommendation to improve the conflict of interest or public integrity provisions of our statute, which involve disclosing financial interests so that the public and the members themselves can be more aware of their own interests when they might be taking votes that might have some personal benefit. And I will have some time at the end for questions. I also invite members to call me anytime about the recommendations or about bills that you're drafting, and we can help you and get the language that will work them into the statute. Whether the board supports them or not, we're happy to help with drafting those bills.
Before you go on, I just want to emphasize that point. You have been extremely responsive over the years, whether I've been in the majority or the minority, and members should really take them up on that. If you have a bill idea or want to bounce a bill draft off of Mr. Goldsmith or his staff, I found over the years he's been very responsive. And I think sometimes, especially for new members, there's this impression that there are the layers and layers of staff between the person that you're looking at here and you, and that's not the case. I think some returning members know, they may not, but new members may certainly not know that you can just call up Mr. Goldsmith or others in the office, and they're happy to help you and give you their candid assessment about whether something is doable or not. Go ahead, Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you. And that's mm-hmm. not to minimize the value that we place and your committee will place in Mr. Gehring. We work closely with him, both on bills that we create and on bills that he creates. So there's usually some interaction between the board and this committee at staff level as well. I wanted to talk today more about the fundamental foundations of campaign finance regulation and what we regulate and why we regulate it, what we don't regulate, and what the board will be recommending that we bring into the regulation system. There are really about four cases, Supreme Court cases, that relate to this subject. There are lots more, but there are really four key cases. They're actually right here, and I've read them all. In fact, I read them probably once a year, and I've just completed reading them again.
it all begins with the First Amendment, which says that Congress can enact no law abridging the freedom of speech, and the 14th Amendment applies that to the states. And campaign speech is core speech. It's political speech that has the highest protection under the First Amendment. And so anytime we try to regulate campaign speech, we start running up against the First Amendment right away. In 1974, Congress enacted the Federal Election Campaign Act, which for the first time comprehensively regulated campaign finance at the federal level. Minnesota enacted its law at the same time, which is now Chapter 10A, much of which is still intact. Immediately following that, many provisions were challenged in court. The first case, and there's a handout, a primer, you don't need to follow it today, you can use it at your leisure. It really tells you what you need to know about the fundamentals of campaign finance regulation. But the first case was Buckley versus Valeo, and you'll hear that over and over. And one of the fundamental things that Buckley versus Valeo decided, and people still disagree with it, but it's core law now, and that is that in the political context, money equals speech. So if you're regulating money, you're regulating speech, and it has the exact same First Amendment protections. Buckley also recognized that there were sort of two kinds of organizations. Organizations that are formed for the purpose of influencing elections, and in Minnesota that's parties, candidate committees, and political committees. But there are also other organizations that want to get involved in the political process, but they have some other main purpose. These are often 501c4 corporations, trade associations, interest groups. And Buckley recognized that for these major purpose groups, like candidate committees, we can regulate their money to a larger degree, and we can control, we can require disclosure of almost everything that they do, in fact, of everything they do. However, for the other groups, which we call non-major purpose associations, we're more limited in what we can require for disclosure and what we can regulate. And in Minnesota, these groups are called the political funds of associations that have them. So an association creates an account called its political fund. The association may be a trade group that exists for other purposes, but it wants to do some political spending. Buckley stands for several things that have been incorporated into Minnesota law. Minnesota law was amended extensively in 1976, right after Buckley. And so one of the things that came out of that is that we can, in fact, limit the amount of money that an individual or an association can donate to a candidate or to a party unit. And in Minnesota, we do limit that amount with respect to candidates, but we have not opted to limit the contribution amounts that can be given to party units, even though constitutionally we have. The board is not recommending that we take that step. More importantly, Buckley decided we cannot do certain things. We can't limit the total amount that can be spent on a candidate's election. In Minnesota, we limit that by a public subsidy agreement where the candidate voluntarily agrees to limit their spending in exchange for government money. We also can't limit the amount of money that an individual candidate can give to their own committee. And we do that, again, through the public subsidy agreement. So if you don't agree to the spending limit, you can spend all you want on your own committee. And we can't limit the amount that anybody spends on independent expenditures. And so in Minnesota and everywhere, there are no limits on independent expenditures. Now, at the end of Buckley, there were a couple of prohibitions that had not even been called into question, and that was the prohibition on corporate contributions to candidates and party units, and at that time, the corporate prohibition on independent expenditures. And you know that's changed since Buckley in 1974. Those prohibitions actually applied to unions as well, but Minnesota has not actually applied the prohibitions to unions who can act through political funds using members' dues, but Minnesota has applied those prohibitions to corporations. The last principle that Buckley recognized was that, and let me say that for the rest of my presentation, I'm mostly going to talk about regulating associations who have a major purpose of something other than politics. So nonprofit corporations and trade associations and so on. Buckley said that for those groups, you can regulate their spending on communications if those communications expressly advocate for or against a candidate.
And in a footnote, Buckley said, expressly advocating means using magic words. Buckley didn't say magic words, but cases after that called them the Buckley magic words. And those are words like vote for, vote against, support, oppose, and so on. And that principle has been written into Minnesota statute. It's in the definition of independent expenditure, which says that an independent expenditure is a communication that expressly advocates for or against the election of a candidate. So for these types of groups, we regulate and require disclosure of independent expenditures that expressly advocate, and also, of course, of direct contributions. There was never a question that those could be regulated. This definition of these magic words presented a problem in that people were avoiding then regulation and disclosure by simply not using the magic words. They would have ads that looked for every purpose, like an advocacy ad, but didn't use those words. And so the federal legislature enacted McCain-Feingold, the bicameral campaign reform act, and brought those types of communications into the regulation system. And they did that in two ways, really. One, they defined a new kind of communication. It's called an electioneering communication. And it doesn't really matter what the ad says, as long as it mentions a clearly identified candidate that is 30 days before the primary or 60 days before the general election and is distributed to the relevant electorate. That was challenged as well by these nonprofits and trade associations and interest groups. The challenge was, you can't regulate these things unless they use the magic words, going back to Buckley. And in McConnell, and that is Mitch McConnell, in fact, who was joined by a lot of other interest groups and sued the FEC, in McConnell versus FEC, the court held that the magic words aren't actually necessary. You can regulate if the expenditure uses the magic words or if it's the functional equivalent of express advocacy. And by that, the court meant, and this was refined in a subsequent case, meant that the communication as you looked at it couldn't be interpreted as anything else but advocacy of the candidate's election. Now, up to that point, corporate contributions were still prohibited and corporate independent expenditures were still prohibited. And I'm going to skip Wisconsin, Right to Life versus FEC, that refined some of those positions, and jump right to Citizens United, which you've all heard about because it just came out in 2010. Citizens United again challenged these provisions and specifically challenged the prohibition on corporate and union independent expenditures and on corporate and union electioneering communications, which didn't expressly advocate but mentioned a named candidate. And as you probably know, the court heard the matter, then decided that wanted further briefing, reheard it, and in the end declared unconstitutional the prohibition on corporate independent expenditures and electioneering communications. For Minnesota, the union part of that didn't really have any effect, but the corporation part did. And the legislature then in 2010 amended the law to accommodate the ruling of Citizens United, and we recognized then independent expenditure committees and funds in which corporations could use their own money as well as money they raised and make independent expenditures using that money. We also erected barriers so that that corporate money could not be manipulated in a way that it would get to candidates or party units, because that prohibition still exists. That prohibition is certainly under challenge. There are courts, cases working their way up to the Supreme Court. They will no doubt reach the Supreme Court, and there are serious questions, at least in my mind, as to whether the prohibition on those direct contributions will survive once it reaches the court, particularly if it reaches the court in its current composition. Having said that, I just want to take a couple of more minutes to actually give you examples so you can understand the difference between these kinds of communications, and I'll point out then what we regulate and what we don't in Minnesota. And so for that, you can turn to the handout that starts with the label independent expenditure. Now, I want you to understand that the fact that we've used these particular graphics, it doesn't mean anything. Two of them we used because they were readily available in an article that was published in the media. One of them was the subject of a complaint filed with the board. Two of them, in fact, were subjects of complaints filed with the board. In each case, they are perfectly legal.
The disclosure that was done was correct if there was disclosure done. In some cases, it wasn't required. So to use these doesn't suggest anything wrong or improper about the publisher of these communications. What I want to use them for is to describe where our disclosure ends and then, by extension, where the board is recommending it be extended. So the first one is an independent expenditure, and these are very common. And it simply mentions a candidate, and you'll see it says, for jobs in a balanced budget, vote for the candidate. So it has those words of express advocacy. It actually uses the magic words, so there's no question this is an independent expenditure. If you make enough of them, you'll have to register with the board and begin to report both your sources of money used for these expenditures and the expenditures themselves. Then I want to turn to the next page that says the functional equivalent of express advocacy, avoiding the magic words. So if you look at this, you can see it contrasts two candidates, one quite favorably, the other one very unfavorably. We investigated this matter in the context of a complaint filed with the board and recognized that these were certainly for the purpose of influencing that particular election. A reasonable person, I don't think, could draw any conclusion other than that. And so under the McConnell and Wisconsin Right to Life decisions, these would be the functional equivalent of express advocacy. However, Minnesota law never changed after Buckley versus Vallejo. It still requires express advocacy, and because of the history and the history board interpretations, in Minnesota we still adhere to the idea that you have to use the magic words before your communication will be subject to regulation. Now, I think the board could extend that by definition, although by administrative rule. The board hasn't done that and would prefer that the legislature examine that. And so one of our recommendations will be that we follow McConnell versus FEC, Wisconsin Right to Life, and adopt a definition of independent expenditures or express advocacy that doesn't require the use of those magic words. And that then would bring this kind of communication within our disclosure system, where now it is not. The next is a picture of a billboard. We also investigated this matter. Again, no magic words. And I have a question mark, functional equivalent of express advocacy, yes, no. It's very interesting because it was published just during the election time, of course, but it doesn't say vote for. One could certainly argue that it is for no other purpose but to influence the election. I think that's the position the board would have taken. However, it's also interesting to recognize that if you added the words, thank you, Amy Cope, for guiding us through a difficult session or something, then perhaps it wouldn't be considered to be the functional equivalent and wouldn't be subject to regulation. Which brings us then to the final piece, electioneering communications, which don't require the express advocacy or its functional equivalent. All they require is a clearly identified candidate within the relevant time frame close to an election promulgated to the electorate. So this billboard would have met that definition. And the last example is another one. It's very similar to the first one, which was an independent expenditure, but it doesn't say vote for, and in fact it could be subject to another interpretation. It could be subject to the interpretation that people just want to thank the representative for what she's done and express their appreciation. So an electioneering communication statute would bring this within our disclosure system, whereas merely expanding in independent expenditures would not. And so the board is also going to be recommending that we add an electioneering communications provision similar to the federal provision. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Goldsmith, we have about a minute and a half left, but I want to just get a sense of the timing here, because obviously we have deadlines in this committee. And so you're going to be, by interoffice mail, getting to members your current recommendations, but I understand you may have more after your next meeting. When is that, and how soon do you think we could get the benefit of your committee's thoughts?
Mr. Chair and members, actually the current recommendations are the complete recommendations in their broad form, which includes a recommendation that the conflict of interest disclosure provisions be strengthened. The board did say that it wants to look at an actual draft of a bill from staff at its February meeting, so there will be more detail, but there won't be an actual new recommendation. Timing-wise, I will get the recommendations in their broad form to you. I've promised various members that bill drafting should be generally done by the end of the month, and we would look at introductions early in February.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any other member comments, questions in a remaining half a minute? Representative Rudolph?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what if someone happens to own a restaurant and they're running for old state representative and they have on the billboard the picture of the candidate and it says, John Doe eats at Fred's Cafe, and John owns Fred's Cafe. Is that a campaign expense or a business expense?
Mr. Goldsmith.
I would probably need some more facts on it. If it's out in front of the restaurant, we would look at, I guess, purpose, but also there'll be some financial thresholds too, so that not every expenditure is going to be brought into the system.
I could give you the specific case, but that'll be offline.
I'll be happy to talk about it.
Members, I don't think Ms. Ahmed came today, right? Ms. Ahmed is not here among us? No. Okay. Members, thanks a lot for your patience, and we will next meet at our next meeting on Tuesday. Meeting is adjourned.